Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In this episode, Bio member Simon Reed talks with Daniel Brook about his book, The Einstein of Sex, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, Visionary of Weimar Berlin, published by W.W. Norton in May 2025. This interview was recorded on November 20th, 2025, via Zoom.
Daniel, it's great to chat with you today. Einstein of Sex, an absolute brilliant book. Magnus Hirschfeld, he's such an interesting guy to spend time with. You know, he's so many things. He's a bon vivant. He's a cultural philosopher. He's a trailblazer in his thinking. He sort of reshapes people's understandings around gender and sexuality. And yet he is criminally overlooked and sort of criminally unknown. And so right out of the gate, I want to ask you, you know, when did you first hear about Magnus Hirschfeld and what made you feel like his story was, you know, worthy of telling?
I first heard of Magnus Hirschfeld when I literally stumbled upon him. It was 2009. I was in Germany for the first time, actually doing some unrelated reporting in Hamburg. Decided I might as well, if you're in Germany, you might as well go to Berlin. Took the train to Berlin for a weekend and encountered Magnus Hirschfeld's bust in the Berlin Jewish Museum. And I grew up like Jewish kid raised on Long Island in the 80s and 90s, had, I would say, more Holocaust education than was probably psychologically healthy. And I never heard of Magnus Hirschfeld. All it mentioned at the Jewish Museum, it was just a one-off. It was bust, which was a gift for his 60th birthday. And it was paraded around, I think it was a replica. It was paraded around at the book burning. It mentioned Magnus Hirschfeld was a queer rights activist. He was a scientist. He was an intellectual. He was a member of the Social Democratic Party and was this huge cultural figure in Berlin before the Nazis, such that when the Nazis took power, it was literally his archive they were burning on that infamous night in 1933 as they paraded this bust around of his head. And I never, of course, I knew the book burning so well, I could probably run the newsreel footage in my mind's eye, but I never heard of Hirschfeld. And I thought this was a really glaring omission. And as it turned out, you know, as I went down the rabbit hole, it became clear that he was world famous in his day. Honestly, the Nazis hated him, but they couldn't stop talking about him even after he dies in exile of natural causes. They keep dredging him back up for their propaganda. It's really the U.S. during the Cold War Red Scare and Lavender Scare that disappears Hirschfeld. And that's why I never heard about him.
He's very far ahead in terms of his thinking. And he believes that gender and sexuality, they're not simple either or categories. They're a lot more varied and individual. What do you think helped him grasp that complexity when everyone else around him sort of viewed the world in very strict black and white binary categories? I mean, he seems from a very early age to have a very open mind, and he's sort of tuned into new ideas and new ways of thinking.
As early as 1896, in his first gay rights pamphlet, he's already arguing that sexual orientation is a continuum. We generally in America call this the Kinsey scale. There's incredibly strong circumstantial evidence that Kinsey just straight up stole that from him and published it in 1948, literally, you know, more than 50 years later. Then when he moves to gender, yeah, he begins to see gender as a continuum. He realizes that masculinity and femininity present itself in all different areas of us, you know, physically, culturally, in terms of our interests. And when you really drill down into an individual human being, you find some unique mixture of masculinity and femininity. And then finally, in his final work on race, which is a takedown of Nazi race theory, he argues that our racial backgrounds are really unique to us. Our race is just a record of all the reproductive sex our ancestors had, whether they talked about it or not. And he speculates one day there'll be a blood test that can prove all of this. Of course, as we know, it ended up being a cheek swab. But I know from my own, you know, I got this gigantic blob of literally going from Ireland to Bangladesh. And, you know, the big ones are where my ancestors actually immigrated from. But there's all kinds of other things that got mixed in along the way. Now, why is he such a visionary? I mean, that's a great question. Part of it is that he's doing the research. He's seeing queer patients and gender nonconforming patients coming to his medical practice. And he sees that there's not this like one size fits all system for either sexual orientation or gender dysphoria. And then I also think, I suspect that the the actual German language, which I was learning to, as which I've been learning, and I'm still learning because it's hard.
Not easy.
having three genders may shape on some very primal level this German brilliance in terms of sex research and gender. I certainly know friends who grew up speaking French or Spanish at home, you know, and I asked them, you know, when you were 4 years old, did you think the pen was a little boy and the table was a little girl? They say, absolutely, yes. So then German being this very unusual language that has a neither nor gender in addition to masculine and feminine may shape how Hirschfeld and other German theorists have seen gender over the years.
When you look at like sort of what he did, what he promoted, the studies he did, I mean, he is a man of like incredible moral courage as well, sort of doing what he did in the time frame.
And part of what really appealed to me about him is his humanness, is he is an individual of tremendous moral courage, but it also takes some doing and it takes a while for him to get there. Initially, he's very quiet about his medical practice. He actually hangs out, his father was a medical doctor. He hangs out his dad's shingle, his late father's shingle. It says, you know, Dr. Hirschfeld, obstetrics and medicine and obstetrics. Now, Magnus Hirschfeld is not delivering babies, but obstetrics is like a little nod and a wink that sex is going to be one of the things you can talk to in his practice. And then he has these queer patients coming through and he thinks he's, you know, he's guiding them towards self-acceptance. And he's even saying, I mean, patients would come and say, you know, oh, doctor, you need to cure me. And he says, no, that you're not sick. This is just how you are. And you might be happier if you went to this bar on Tuesday nights after 10, you might even meet a boyfriend or a girlfriend and you'd be a much happier person. So he's guiding them in this way, but he's doing it quietly. And then one of his patients takes his own life. Magnus calls him Lieutenant von X to sort of signal that he's, well, von is that he's noble, lieutenant, that he's a military man, and X to preserve his anonymity. And he takes his own life and he sends Hirschfeld a letter saying that, you know, all the private psychotherapy in the world is not going to solve this problem because there's a law in the books that makes it a crime punishable by imprisonment for a man to have sex with a man in Germany that has to be overturned. That also creates all kinds of possibilities for blackmail, where highborn gay men like Lieutenant von X can be extorted to keep this to the secret, which is a criminal secret, crime a secret. And then Hirschfeld just dips his toe in and publishes this pamphlet in 1896 called Sappho and Socrates, or What Explains the Love of People for Their Own Sex, under a pseudonym, this mythical Dr. Thomas Ramin of Berlin. In the second edition, 2 years later, Hirschfeld is finally willing to openly be this advocate for queer rights and comes out as the author and puts his name on it. And then, you know, in this very human way, leads this public campaign that puts literally his life in danger. As early as 1920, right-wing thugs are trying to stone him to death in the streets of Munich. He's chased out of Germany long before almost any other leftist Jewish German, et cetera, is thrown out. He leaves in the winter of 1930-31. Nazis don't fully take power and destroy this institute he built till 1933.
We just covered a lot in that answer. And one of the things I was going to ask you about, and you sort of talked about already, was that his scientific work was very much inseparable from the deep compassion he felt for people. You think that empathy was sort of key to his role as a researcher and an activist? Do you think he would have had the impact he had without the empathy?
Yeah, I mean, so he's growing up a gay Jewish boy in the rising Germany, which in tandem with its rise is actually having a kind of relapse of anti-Semitism and a relapse of homophobia. It should be said that the French Revolution, this is something I learned actually from Hirschfeld's writings while I was researching the book. The French Revolution was a sexual revolution. In addition to...
I learned that from your book. I had no idea.
I mean, in addition to, you know, obviously abolishing the aristocracy and granting people freedom of conscience to practice whatever religion they wanted as equal citizens, it also decriminalized any consensual sex act between adults. So you went from a France where literally gay men would be burned at the stake in the Middle Ages for this heretical crime, right? And women, lesbians, times would be burned as quote-unquote witches, to a free modern society where adults can have the sexual relations they desire in the privacy of their home, we should say. There were still laws against public incidents. And then there's this backsliding. So actually Napoleon forces this sexual revolution on all of Europe as he conquers it. And then parts of Europe begin to recriminalize certain sex acts. Actually, Italy, for example, does not, but Germany does. And when Magnus is just this young boy, probably too young to read the papers and even know what's going on, Germany passes this law called Paragraph 175 that makes it a crime punishable by prison for a man to have sex with a man. So that's hanging over him. That's where his initial empathy comes from, I would say. And then he, as he matures into adulthood, kind of spreads this empathy wider and wider, ultimately really to embrace the whole world. You know, he ends up on the run from the Nazis, circumnavigating the globe, doing research that he publishes on gender nonconformity, on trans communities, all and matriarchal societies all over the world. So by the end, he's living this kind of fully global life.
Definitely a world traveler. We'll get to that soon. We just mentioned the Nazis. I mean, they did single him out. You know, they attack his institute. They burn his research, his archives. You know, what made him such a uniquely threatening figure? Because as you said, like, even after he died, they're still like dredging him up. Like, why was he such a danger to them?
On some level, it's because he checks all the boxes, right? He's Jewish. He's gay. He's an intellectual. He's a scientist. He's an active member of the Social Democratic Party. And he's involved in the cultural sphere. He's making gay rights films and writing gay rights pamphlets and newspaper articles and open letters. But I think ultimately, he's the biggest threat, not so much for the boxes he checks, but because he thinks outside all of the boxes. He argues that first with sexual orientation, then with gender, and finally with race, that humanity is a continuum. And that any attempt to kind of split humanity into freaks and normies, or a kind of majoritarian us and a minoritarian them, speaks volumes about the person or party or demagogue making those distinctions, but doesn't really say much about the human population, which is itself this continuum. And once you've dynamited the foundation of this us and them politics, you've really dynamited the foundation of fascist politics and the Nazis politics. And I think ultimately that's why they had to drive him out, and why he was their public enemy number one in a society in vibrant Weimar Berlin that had no shortage of people who could have been singled out as the Nazis' public enemy number one.
The book is broad in its scope, right? So it's part intellectual history, it's part biography, it's part cultural portrait. It covers all these things. When you were writing it, how did you decide on, you know, the balance between Hirschfeld's ideas, his personal life, these amazing sort of dramatic world events he's sort of living in the middle of? How did you strike that balance and not get overwhelmed by any sort of one area?
Yeah, I'm a journalist by trade, and I'll go to the wall for this. I'm convinced that journalists, you know, are the best people for portraying the full breadth of events of a human life and the full breadth of a city like Weimar Berlin. That's kind of in some sense almost incomprehensible, and that's because, you know, as a journalist, you're not specialized. You can't take one lens and exclude all the other lenses. You have to see things in a bigger picture. I was fortunate enough to win Bio's Robert Nina Caro Research Travel Fellowship, which took me to Berlin, literally generously endowed by Robert Nina Caro, the leading English language biographers. I think it's fair to say the living English language biographers. And the little blurb at the top of the fellowship application is a quote from Robert Caro that says, you know, if to paraphrase, if you're trying to bring a character to life, going to the actual places where this life was lived, particularly, you know, if it was very formative, like the childhood home or the childhood school, is going to bring that character to life on the page in a way that otherwise you can't. My research method kind of ended up being this sort of omnivorousness where everything was fair game. You know, of course, it could be things I read, but it could also be something I saw in a museum. That's actually right where this whole project came from. It could be going to Hirschfeld's hometown in what was then East Prussia, is now part of Poland, and sort of seeing this, sounds funny today, Baltic Sea Resort. It's like a summer beach town. Yeah. And it wasn't in Hirschfeld's time, too. It's actually even a bigger deal in Hirschfeld's time because it was before air travel. And getting the sense of this beach town and then how it kind of closes up each fall and what must have been Hirschfeld's sense of like, oh, the real world has packed up and left and I need to sort of get out of this little beach town is charming. And
he felt confined actually from a very young age there, didn't he? He like had a happy like family life, but he felt very constricted.
Certainly by his adolescence, he realizes he's gay, and that gay life in a town this small is going to be quite protracted. And then just that, you know, he goes to bigger cities for his education, and even Germany itself and Europe itself kind of constricts him. He gets his medical degree, which is essentially the family tradition. His father was a doctor. One big brother's a doctor. One big brother's a pharmacist. It's kind of like he's sort of fated to become a medical doctor, but immediately he essentially runs away with the circus. One of his brothers had emigrated to Chicago, and he moves in with him and becomes a stringer for German language newspapers and covers the World's Fair of 1893 in Chicago. So he's very reluctant. Certainly not going to be a small town doctor like his father.
Was it, if I remember correctly, was it in Chicago where like if men wore a red tie,
Yeah, so he's experiencing, you know, he's in his mid-20s and he's overseas for the first time. So his trip is to, he goes to Chicago and then he comes back to Germany via North Africa and Italy. His academic advisor is giving a talk in Rome. And he uses that as an excuse to basically take the very long way home, goes up through Morocco and Algeria and Italy and up, back up to Germany. About 2 decades later, he writes about queer life in Chicago, queer life in North Africa, queer life in Italy. And all of this is like phrases, this sober scientific German, they in Chicago, the homosexuals do this. In Morocco, the homosexuals do this. Every so often it sort of slips into the second person. He's writing about the hammams in North Africa. And he says, you know, there are masseurs there, but every so often you find the masseur and the customer next to you. You know, you kind of know there's a story there. Right. You don't quite know what it is. And as a biographer, that was what I found so fun about this character, because one of his translators who lives in Berlin, is from Australia and lives in Berlin, and his book's out in English, Berlin's Third Sex, amazing book by Hirschfeld, translated by James Conway, said, James Conway said, you know, of all the people I translate, he was so frustrating because he's so close to the vest and he doesn't really let you in. And it's all this kind of very third person-y thing. And for me as the biographer, I thought that made it so much fun because we know a lot about his life. And then we have this huge voluminous work of material that he produced. And they clearly are, you know, one is growing out of the other. And then as the biographer to sort of connect those dots, I thought was really a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, how did you uncover sort of like, you know, the personal and emotional side? Because also the stuff he's writing about sexuality, gender, you know, people weren't openly discussing this stuff back in that day. You know, you're probably dealing with a lot of like euphemisms like we sort of just discussed. Was it a challenge sort of getting to know him as a person beyond just sort of the scientist and the researcher?
The general facts of his life are very, very well documented, have been well documented for a long time, both by him. He kept a travel diary, which is, that is in the first person. He publishes other books in the third person. There are, in German and English, there are previous biographies. The most recent English language biography was from the 1980s, which is like the dark ages in terms of trans rights, certainly. But we do have a pretty good documentation of the general arc of his life, but then it's just making the connections. So for example, he found something called the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, which is a gay rights organization working to repeal paragraph 175, this infamous law that I've described. And it starts as, to even Hirschfeld would describe it, as this kind of middle class to upper class gay men's organization that is advocating to change this law. Okay, it's founded 1897. A few years later, one of the, actually the highest born of these individuals, I think we should say, Baron von Teschenberg, who's an actual baron, gives Hirschfeld a carte de visite. These are these visiting calling cards of the day where you'd have a portrait and contact information. If someone came to your house for tea and you weren't there, they would sort of leave it with your butler. It's kind of very highfalutin social custom. And the Baron von Teschenberg's carte de visite have the Baron von Teschenberg in this long flowing gown with an updo. And the Baron von Teschenberg tells Hirschfeld, this is my true nature, and I want you to publish this carte de visite in the next issue of the scientific journal that you put out, the Journal of Sexual Intermediary. So what had begun even I think in Hirschfeld's mind as this movement of gay men had become something very different. And then that's at the beginning of Hirschfeld's turn towards trans identity. He publishes in 1910, that's 6 years after this carte de visite is presented to him. He publishes a book called Die Transvestiten, which is translates as the transvestites. That's not a word we would use today, but it is the first sympathetic study of trans individuals. It's very clear to me that, you know, this incident with one of the founders of the Scientific Humanitarian Committee coming out to Hirschfeld as trans, and then clearly influences his research into trans identity and gender. Similarly, you know, Hirschfeld, it's very clear, you know, thrown out of his country on ostensibly racial grounds, that he's a Semite and he can't be an Aryan and he's not really German. That, of course, triggers his thinking about race, but so does going to America during Jim Crow in the 30s. And then he ends up in China. He ends up in a romantic relationship with a young Chinese medical student from Hong Kong. And they begin traveling the world together. And Hirschfeld gets to see what, you know, what is it like to travel the sort of British colonial era world, looking, you know, if you have East Asian features, and just seeing the racism that's just stalking this guy all over the world, you know, is clearly related to his book Racism, which is again presented as this kind of sober scientific takedown of Nazi race theory, where he doesn't mention, and I was traveling the world with my East Asian boyfriend. And, you know, he does a nod at the beginning to, like, obviously I am a Jew who's been thrown out of Germany because for quote unquote racial reasons. So, like, that's part of the impetus. But that's the only time in his work where he really does acknowledge the personal connection. And it's because it's unavoidable. It's just everyone already knows. So it's like the elephant in the room. Let's just get it out at the beginning.
Right. When you were researching this book, it seems to me, I mean, you must have been faced with the challenge right off the bat, though, because the Nazis destroyed so many of his personal papers and his archives. I mean, did that present any unique challenges, or was there enough other existing material where you felt comfortable early on going, okay, there's enough here to flesh this guy out?
He was a big enough deal that, like, actually by the end of his life, his books are coming out in German, French, and English simultaneously. Actually, his final book, Racism, is published in English, can't be published in German at the time because the Nazis run all the German publishing houses. There's a huge trove of his material. There's also a trove of material that was thought to be lost, that was amassed in Berlin at something called the Magnus Hirschfeld Society, which was created by, in the 1970s, a group of young gay men in West Berlin started hearing rumors in the cafes and bars and clubs from the older guys saying, you know, you wouldn't believe it, but before the Nazis, this was the place. And they had no idea that memory of the city had been really destroyed. And they began doing this kind of like wildcat historical research, including contacting anyone who had been a patient at the Institute or had worked with the Institute. And they were physically amassing newspaper clippings and documents like trans IDs. The Berlin police would issue these trans IDs so people could present in the clothing they wanted to without fear of arrest. And they began making sort of contact in Cold War times, including with someone named Gerd Kotter, who's a trans man who's living in East Germany, you know, like 30 miles from West Berlin, but with the wall. And making arrangements with tap phone lines and IDs and passport control and Checkpoint Charlie and all of that to physically re-amass the material. So in a lot of ways, I think like a lot of biographers, but maybe even more so than most because of this deliberate attempt to destroy the materials, I'm really just in such debt to the archivists who amassed this material, that so much of which was, you know, could have been lost.
Archivists are the biographer's secret weapon. Hirschfeld's life, it includes activism, science, cabaret culture, travel, politics, danger, intrigue. I mean, obviously you had an idea of who this guy was before you started, but were you surprised at how varied his existence was? And when you were writing the book, was there a challenge from keeping yourself from drifting too much into the academic versus too much into the adventure story side of his life?
Yeah, I mean, initially what attracted to me about Hirschfeld was his mind. I mean, I realized, so I encountered him in the Berlin Jewish Museum and actually just like filed it away, note to self, this guy's really interesting, and came back to it. It was actually in the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum, and there was a plaque on the wall that mentioned that the word racism did not exist in the 19th century. And I just finished my previous book, The Accident of Color, A Story of Race and Reconstruction. I read a gazillion newspaper articles and magazine articles from The Nation and Harper's and the New Orleans newspapers and the Charleston newspapers and from the late 1800s. And it's like, oh, now that you mention it to me, yeah, the word racism never shows up. It's bigotry, white supremacy, prejudice. Like, so where'd the word racism come from? I'm on my phone and it says, oh, well, it's controversial, but you know, Magnus Hirschfeld publishes the first book in the English language with that uses that word. And I'm like, well, and then I keep going digging. It's like, oh, but he's really famous for coining transvestite 25 years earlier. So that's what attracted me, was like the same mind kind of figured out social construction of race and gender as a continuum. So it was really kind of this exciting intellectual project. And then as I went in, it was like, whoa, this guy's life is such a romp. He's going all over the world and he's in this polyamorous relationship and he's like the sort of the linchpin of gender bending Weimar cabaret culture and all that. So I really, you know, ultimately wanted to a biography that did justice to both, because sometimes you can have a biography of a major intellectual figure that is, the intellectual work is almost the exclusion of the life. Sometimes you get biographers of major intellectual figures who live these kind of fun high society lives, and it becomes just this like kind of gossip manual where their ideas get lost or are almost ignored. And I really worked hard to try to get those two in balance. I mean, not only because I think they're both compelling,
but because I think they're so deeply intertwined. You know, he's not sitting in an ivory tower
writing
about critical race theory. He's like
on
the run from the Nazis. He's like in the club at 2 a.m. when the drag king performer comes out. It's all intertwined.
The book is so lively. I'd never heard of Hirschfeld when I started reading it. It's a page turner. I mean, it really sinks you into the time and the place and the experiences. It's a fantastic read, and you sort of strike the balance wonderfully. And, you know, obviously we've been talking a lot about how he was so multifaceted. When you start tackling a biographical topic, you usually go with a preconceived notion of who this person is, or you have your own beliefs about him. Was there anything during your research, any discovery you made that surprised you or sort of challenged your early sense of who Hirschfeld was?
I was in contact with this translator in Berlin quite early. And I remember getting the email. Wait, this is a translator, James Conway. He specializes in works of the early 20th century in Germany translated that have not been translated to English. And he wrote me this email about how frustrating he finds Hirschfeld and how he finds him like, he's such a tough nut to crack and you never really meet him and you never really know him. And I was not, when I got that email, I thought, oh no, what have I bitten off? Like if this guy who's written these little biographical squibs for everyone he translates, or, you know, half a dozen of these historical figures thinks that, you know, this is the one that's like the impossible one to write about. I was nervous, you know, I didn't let it dissuade me. And then I took it as a challenge. And that's what ultimately surprised me was that this guy who's such a sort of brilliant theorist was just so much a creature of the world and just had this kind of lust for life that ultimately is, I think is just, it's such a vindication of sort of him and his project. It, of course, the, you know, the opening epigram of the book, you know, there's an Anne Frank quote at the very beginning. And we understand, you know, we're reading about a gay Jewish kid born in Germany in the late 1860s. And you can do the math and you know, the whole time, like something, you know, there's the specter of Nazism and specter of the Holocaust is kind of lurking in the background. And yet against that specter that does kind of haunt the book, he's living this fabulous life.
That's what made him like so enjoyable to be around with. He did. He had like a real passion. Was there a point in your research for the book where you realized it was going to be about something larger than sexology? You know, because the book is sort of really about who society allows to belong and behave the way they want to and sort of be themselves. Did you know the book was going to sort of encompass all of that when you went into it? Or was that something that kind of evolved as you were sort of researching?
I sort of went into Hirschfeld backwards because I knew about the race work, which is his last work and honestly, his least famous work, because he has been rediscovered in gender studies and in queer studies and is known as this seminal queer rights activist and gay icon, but isn't really known for his race work. And since I kind of went into it through his lesser known work, that's what initially captivated me was that I realized he did this work on race and he did this work on gender. And I want to piece that all together, whereas, you know, a lot of other, particularly academic scholars, you know, are just going looking at one little aspect of his work. So, yeah, that was what captivated me from the start.
How long did you spend working on this book?
5 years.
5 years.
which for better or worse seems to be about how long it takes me to do these things. And I should say, I kind of did it. I also ended up kind of researching it backwards because of the pandemic. Right. My plan was to go to Berlin and to this hometown where he grew up in Poland on the front end, and then craft the manuscript and then do the research and craft the manuscript. Right. I ended up, because of the pandemic, doing it on the back end. I actually went on this fellowship in the summer of 2023, I went with a fully written manuscript in hand. And then as I went through Germany and Poland, I would make notes and tweaks and kind of sort of tear it apart. And then I came back with a messier manuscript that I had to clean up. And that's what ultimately got turned into my publisher and turned into the book.
After spending 5 years with him and, you know, just immersing yourself, what is it that you hope readers take away from sort of this book? Not just about him, but maybe about, you know, sort of the time period he was in and maybe current culture we exist in now.
This is not the world I thought I was dropping this book into. And so I'm as shocked and horrified as anyone that we're at the point we are. What initially attracted me to Hirschfeld was how ahead of his time he was, that he had done critical race theory so much before. Social construction of race so much before anyone else, gender is a continuum, and trans rights so far before anyone else. I should say, in the background of my research and writing, my niece was transitioning. So it felt very personal to me. I was really upset that I never heard about Hirschfeld, because processing my niece's trans identity would have been a lot easier if I had read Hirschfeld. She was born in 2002. I went through the early 2000s being like, oh, I guess I'm the uncle to a gay nephew. And one day my gay nephew will tell us he is gay and I will say, I love you, we know. In hindsight, my niece was like the most archetypal trans individual ever. Like all of her avatars in video games were little girls. She declared herself the princess of the universe at age 5. Her Halloween costumes were all female characters. And the idea that, you know, someone had figured all of this out literally 100 years ago, and that I, of all people who'd had all this Holocaust education, should have at least heard of the guy. And that all this had been hidden from me, really, you know, then I felt like I'd been mugged, kind of. And that was part of what powered me to sort of to work through this project for 5 years. Actually, the book is dedicated to my niece, and she had done a year of high school in Germany, and her German's better than mine. So she actually came over for a week. We went to the archives, and she was very helpful with the documents.
It really is a fantastic book. And very early on in reading it, I'm like, why haven't I heard of this guy before? I mean, he's such an amazing person to spend time with. I highly encourage anyone listening to check it out, because it is not only an eye-opening book, but it's just a really fun and entertaining book. It really immerses you in sort of the culture and the time period.
Yeah, thanks so much for making time. It's great to be on the podcast.
That was Bio member Simon Reed in conversation with Danielle Brook about his book, The Einstein of Sex, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld, Visionary of Weimar Berlin. It was published by W.W. Norton in May 2025. This interview was recorded via Zoom on November 20th, 2025. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member and producer Jenny Skoog in New York City. Sonia Williams is our executive producer. Darren Nesblid created our theme music. Until next time, thanks for listening.